All right, now I've already talked a little bit about slide 12, but I want to say a little bit more. First of all, to orient you, remember that we are looking at translation here, which is the second part of gene expression. Gene expression is transcription first, we've already covered that, and then translation, which we're going to talk about today. And translation is the part of gene expression in which the polypeptide is actually built, one amino acid at a time. And in order for that polypeptide to function properly, it of course has to have the right shape. And we've already learned that shape is determined by the specific sequence and types of amino acids that make up the polypeptide. Therefore, it's really important in translation to get that sequence correct. You have to use the right number of amino acids, and you have to use exactly the right kind of amino acid in each position for however many positions there are. Well, this involves RNA, but it involves many molecules of RNA, and it involves three different categories of RNA. One of which is, of course, the messenger RNA. The red thing here is the mRNA transcript. And that has the both bits of information. It tells the ribosome how many amino acids there are going to be, because it, however many codons there are, that's how many amino acids there are going to be. And it also tells what specific amino acid needs to occupy each position. The second category of RNA, though, that's involved in this translation process is called ribosomal RNA, small r, RNA. It's not really labeled here, but you see the ribosome here as just these two brown subunits that came together. Well, molecularly speaking, the stuff that makes up the subunits of the ribosome is partly ribosomal RNA and partly proteins, so it's a mixture of stuff. And the rRNA, the ribosomal RNA that makes up the ribosome, is what gives the ribosome its catalytic activity. We are used to already talking about catalysts in general, and in most cases, proteins play the role of catalysts, right? That's what we call enzymes. Enzymes is a word that means a protein acting as a catalyst in a biological system. Well, proteins aren't the only things that can act as catalysts in biology, though. RNA can do that job sometimes, too, and including ribosomal RNA that makes up a ribosome. And we use a different word for that. It's not enzyme, because that word is reserved for proteins. Instead, RNA acting as a catalyst is called ribozyme. Same ending to show you that it's a catalyst. But anyway, that's the second category of RNA involved. And then the third category is transfer RNA, or tRNA, which is labeled here. And there are many different individual tRNAs involved in this process. tRNA gets its name, transfer RNA, because the job of tRNA is to bring in, one at a time, appropriate amino acids to be added to the growing polypeptide that's being built. And this is where it is crucial to get things right. Because if the sequence of amino acids is incorrect, if you use the wrong amino acid even in just one position, that can drastically affect the shape of the polypeptide, and when it doesn't have the right shape, it's not going to operate. It's not going to function. So the information, the integrity of the information, which is in the messenger RNA transcript, needs to be maintained. In other words, when each codon successively gets read, the ribosome needs to make sure that only the correct amino acid gets brought in next, corresponding in the genetic code to that codon. And you can see, for instance, GGC is being read as the current codon in this cartoon. Well, if you look up GGC in the genetic code, that we, the universal genetic code that we looked at a few slides back, that specifies specifically glycine as the amino acid. So to maintain the integrity of the information, there needs to be steps put in place so that only a tRNA carrying glycine is allowed in next to bring specifically glycine as the next amino acid. All right, now that's the job of tRNA, but there are many different kinds of tRNA because there are many different kinds of amino acids that organisms use, right? 20 different amino acids are used by organisms. So there are different kinds of tRNA corresponding to these different kinds of amino acids because any given individual tRNA, if it's carrying an amino acid, if it's connected directly to an amino acid, is allowed to carry only one particular kind of amino acid. This is how the cell maintains the integrity of the information. If you had tRNAs being allowed to carry any kind of amino acid, or even more than one kind of amino acid, then mistakes could be made. You could be bringing in the wrong amino acid compared to what is supposed to be added. Okay, so there's a lot of different kinds of tRNAs. Now, any individual tRNA molecule at any given moment, because this changes from moment to moment, is classified into one of two major categories, but three overall. What I mean here is that a tRNA is either carrying something or not. If a tRNA is not carrying an amino acid, like this one that, after the red arrow here, that's already done its job and has been ejected, both of these actually are carrying nothing, then we call that tRNA an uncharged tRNA. It doesn't have anything to do with electrical charge. Just uncharged comes from the fact that when a cell hooks an amino acid onto a tRNA to allow it to carry it, we say that the tRNA is being charged with that amino acid. Okay, so anyway, one possibility is for a tRNA to be uncharged. It's not carrying anything. The other major possibility, of course, is that it is carrying something. But there's two ways that it can be carrying something. Either an amino acid can be carrying just a single, either a tRNA can be carrying just a single amino acid, or it can be carrying a peptide, meaning a string of some number of amino acids greater than one. If a tRNA is carrying exactly one amino acid, like this one carrying glycine in the picture, then not only is it charged, it's called a charged tRNA, but specifically it is called an aminoacyl tRNA. The word aminoacyl refers to the fact that it's carrying specifically one amino acid. If, on the other hand, a charged tRNA is connected directly to one amino acid, but that amino acid is just part of a string of amino acids, like this one in the middle slot here, it's directly connected to phenylalanine, but it's carrying the entire string that phenylalanine is a part of. So it's not carrying a single amino acid, it's carrying a peptide of some length, and therefore a charged tRNA carrying multiple amino acids is called a peptidyl tRNA. That's the two possibilities for being a charged tRNA. And no tRNA remains in one of these categories forever. It goes through all three of these categories depending on which part of the process it's in. All right? So that's just some definitions. Let's take a closer look at tRNA in slide 13. tRNA, of course, is RNA. And you've already learned that unlike DNA, tRNA is single-stranded. So it's one continuous nucleotide strand, and that's true for tRNA that we're looking at here. Now, this top figure is not how this really looks in three dimensions. But if you were to flatten it out, if you were to force it onto a two-dimensional plane, it would have this so-called clover leaf arrangement, like the three leaflets of a clover. Now, this looks kind of like it's double-stranded, but notice it's all one strand. It's just wrapping back on itself. So there are parts that are complementary, but not because there are two strands. It's just because it loops back. But there's a 3' end and a 5' end, as you would expect for a nucleic acid. The three hairpin loops that make up this clover leaf arrangement are the bends that allow for it to wrap back around and complementarily pair with itself. But the middle of these three hairpin loops is the most important of these, which is the one shown on the bottom of this top figure. Now, the entire length of the tRNA, of course, is A's, U's, C's, and G's. It's a sequence of nucleotides. But this middle hairpin loop at the bottom here features a sequence of three nucleotides collectively called the anticodon. And that is a very important part of this particular tRNA. I said that there are different kinds of tRNA. Each different kind of tRNA has its own anticodon. All right. The reason this sequence of three, or this triplet, is called an anticodon is because it is complementary to, that's the anti part, it's complementary to a certain codon. Well, you know already the rules of complementarity, right? So an anticodon that is AAG would be complementary to a codon that is what? UUC, exactly. And so if you were to look up UUC in the genetic code, it would correspond to an amino acid, right? Well, a tRNA that has an anticodon complementary to that codon is able to carry only that kind of amino acid and no other kind of amino acid. And by the way, when I say carry, it's the 3' end of the tRNA that gets charged. If it's not carrying anything, then the 3' end isn't connected to anything. It's an uncharged tRNA. But if it is charged, then that amino acid will be hooked to the 3' end. And this maintains the integrity of the information, because there's always going to be a complementary correspondence between the codon that's being read in the messenger RNA and only a specific kind of anticodon, right? Well, only a kind of tRNA that has that specific anticodon is allowed in there to match up to that codon, and therefore only that kind of amino acid specified by the codon gets brought in. In three dimensions, if you don't force it into a flat plane, it has this kind of arrangement, which is kind of like this bent peg. That's why they're depicting it as a bent peg. And the whole thing has nucleotides, of course, but this is the sequence we care about, the anticodon. This is the 3' end. Okay, so we're on slide 14. You have in any given cell a pool of all the different kinds of tRNA, many, many copies of each. So you have millions of tRNA molecules in a single cell. Some of them are uncharged, and they can't participate in translation because their job in translation is to bring an amino acid in, right? If they're uncharged, they can't do that. So to prepare them for translation, the uncharged ones need to be charged, and this needs to be a careful process because the cell has to make sure that any given individual tRNA is charged with only the kind of amino acid that it's allowed to carry based on its anticodon. All right? So this happens with the help, not surprisingly, of an enzyme. And they're just like there are different kinds of tRNA corresponding to the different anticodons. There are also different versions of this enzyme family that allow this charging to take place. And so this grayish thing that looks kind of like a human embryo in shape in this figure is the enzyme responsible? This is the one that there's multiple versions of, one for each kind of different tRNA. And the enzyme, notice, is called aminoacyl tRNA synthetase. Aminoacyl tRNA synthetase is not aminoacyl tRNA, right? It's the enzyme that is able to synthesize, which means bring together, two things. A tRNA of a specific kind, and the amino acid that that particular kind of tRNA is allowed to carry. Both of those things come in as substrates into this complicated active site of the synthetase enzyme. So you can see the adenosine in this case is brought in. That's going to provide the ATP is being spent, is what I'm trying to say, to do this. It's not free. Charging a tRNA is expensive, and it should be, right? Because you're joining two things together. But tRNA is brought in and hooked only to the amino acid that's allowed to carry. Those both come in. The energy is spent to form the bond between them, and then this now charged tRNA is ejected, and the synthetase can do the same thing, but only to another kind of this same tRNA, right? The same thing is happening for the other kinds of tRNA. It's just a different version of the synthetase that recognizes only that kind of tRNA. The reason it can recognize the specific kind of tRNA is because the anticodon is part of this fit with the active site. So the enzyme actually recognizes a specific anticodon and will only let that kind of uncharged tRNA in to get charged. Okay, so this is happening in the cell continuously. The uncharged tRNAs are being charged, and that makes a bunch of copies, millions of aminoacyl tRNAs, which are carrying just a single amino acid by definition. And they are just waiting for their number to come up, basically, for their codon to come up. They're not participating in translation yet, but if the next codon that comes up in the reading frame at the ribosome is one that corresponds to their anticodon, then they're allowed in, and they therefore bring just that right kind of amino acid into the process. All right, that's when they will officially be part of translation. Well, that involves, in slide 15, these three slots. We have a cartoon figure of a ribosome here. As we've talked about before, a ribosome is made up of two subunits, a large ribosomal subunit and a small one. And this is kind of a lie, as I've said before, because the two subunits don't actually come together without anything else connected to them. We'll see the truth later on, but just for simplicity, it's showing you the two subunits together. And you can see that the large subunit has three slots in it. Now, if you read these like we do in English, left to right, it looks like EPA. But actually, that's the reverse of the direction in which these are used. A first, and then P, and then E. And these letters, as you can see, correspond to what they do. The A slot is named that because it is the aminoacyl tRNA binding site, meaning this is the incoming slot where one at a time, one aminoacyl tRNA carrying its kind of amino acid comes in to bring that kind of amino acid to the growing strand. The P slot is named for the fact that it's the peptidyl tRNA binding site. So the tRNA that occupies the P slot is the one that's carrying the whole strand up to that point. And the aminoacyl tRNA is bringing in one more amino acid to be added to that. In the E slot, you can think of that as either exit or eject. That is where an uncharged tRNA will be. But if you look at the bottom, the ejected tRNA is uncharged. It's done its job already. So it needs to go back, find its correct kind of aminoacyl tRNA synthetase enzyme, and get recharged so it can be used again. But just the previous moment, it was the peptidyl tRNA. Now you have a new peptidyl tRNA carrying, at this point, four amino acids to making up a peptide. And what's going to happen is that all four of these are going to be transferred from this peptidyl tRNA to the amino acid being carried by this aminoacyl tRNA. And that's going to make it a five amino acid sequence, right? But it's going to make this aminoacyl tRNA the new peptidyl tRNA. And it's going to make this peptidyl tRNA an uncharged tRNA because all of these get transferred over. And so, as this happens, one amino acid at a time, the ribosome moves with respect to the mRNA by three nucleotides, or one codon at a time. So this whole thing shifts, and this peptidyl tRNA, once it loses its amino acids to the other, is going to be uncharged and find itself in the ejection slot because of the shift, and then it will be ejected. Okay, and this one that's now an aminoacyl tRNA but will become a peptidyl tRNA will be shifted into the P slot. And it'll leave the A slot open, reading the next codon, allowing for the next kind of tRNA appropriate for that codon to come in and bring its new amino acid. Okay, well, let's look at this whole process then of translation starting in 16. First, though, think back to transcription, which is an entirely different process, right? Accomplishes an entirely different thing. But I just want you to remember that the process of transcription, which involves the DNA, unlike this, occurred in three major steps, right? There's initiation in transcription, and then elongation, and then termination. Remember those? Well, even though it's totally different stuff happening in translation, it also happens in three steps that have identical names. So translation also has initiation, elongation, and termination. It makes sense because just like in transcription, translation involves building something that's getting longer and longer. So you have to start the process, you have to elongate it, and then you have to stop it. Here in 16, we're looking at initiation of translation. And here we can see why I was calling the previous pictures a lie. Because a ribosome does not exist as both subunits until it starts being used and first binds to mRNA. So you have a pool of unused ribosomes that are just really separate subunits, not together yet. And they're all modular, so it doesn't matter which big one gets fit with which small one. They're all small ones are the same. But it takes a small ribosomal subunit to first bind to the messenger RNA. And the messenger RNA doesn't come on here just randomly. It comes on here a specific way. Remember that in the genetic code, there's one special codon, AUG, that serves as the start codon, right? And that AUG is somewhere in the sequence. It's not right at the beginning of the mRNA. It's somewhere in there. Wherever it is, that gets positioned right in the middle of the small ribosomal subunit. Right? Also, a tRNA that has an anticodon that is complementary to AUG, which we're looking at in close-up right here, specifically a tRNA with a UAC anticodon that corresponds to AUG, comes in and by hydrogen bonding complementarily binds to the mRNA at that position. And of course, this kind of tRNA is allowed only to carry methionine because AUG is not only a start codon, it does double duty as also specifying methionine. Okay, and this is why, whether a polypeptide needs it or not, all polypeptides that are built start out with methionine as the first amino acid, because you have to start with a start codon, which also specifies methionine. Okay, all of that comes together, and then you have to spend some energy not in the form of ATP, but in the form of GTP, which is similar. It just uses a different nitrogenous base, but it works the same way ATP does. It's carrying energy because of its phosphates. And just like ATP, you remove a phosphate to release that energy. So GTP gets spent here, and that allows the large subunit to come along and complete this whole translation initiation complex, as it's called, which is the entire ribosome, both subunits, plus the mRNA, plus the tRNA that's carrying methionine. And notice, when the subunit, when the large subunit comes along, that positions this tRNA in the P slot. Now, this is not a peptidal tRNA, right? This is an exception. The A, P, and E slots are really named for the next part, which is elongation. So yes, this is technically an amino acyl tRNA, but it's occupying the P slot because you have to start with one amino acid. Okay, the A slot, though, is open, and this whatever codon here is in the A slot, which could be any of them, is the one that's currently being read. The methionine has already been added. Now it's time for elongation, 17. And actually this shows you the process already in progress. A few other amino acids have already been added at the top, but every time this goes around, one more gets added because one additional codon gets read by the ribosome. So what we have in the P slot at the top here is officially a peptidyl tRNA at this moment because it's carrying, looks like, four amino acids. The A slot is open, and that has some codon, so only the kind of tRNA with an anticodon complementary to that codon will be allowed in, and it will be carrying only the kind of amino acid that corresponds to that codon. Well, that is going to require some more energy expenditure then after that comes in. In the form of GTP again, shouldn't surprise you that building a polypeptide is going to be expensive, right? You're building a big polymer out of small chunks, so it's going to require a bunch of energy. Anyway, GTP gets spent, and that energy gets put into transferring however many amino acids are making up the peptide being carried by the peptidyl tRNA in the P slot at the moment, to the amino acid that's being carried by the amino acyl tRNA coming into the A slot. That's what the red arrow is figuring. And so notice that any given tRNA, whether it's amino acyl or peptidyl tRNA, is only ever connected, if it's connected at all, to its specific kind of amino acid directly. When it's carrying more than one, it's still only directly connected to the one that it was allowed to carry. The others are then connected to that amino acid. Okay, so this transfers it over, and so that then, as you see on the bottom, makes the former peptidyl tRNA now an uncharged tRNA, and it makes the former amino acyl tRNA the new peptidyl tRNA, and then you have a shift powered by more GTP expenditure, and that's when the new uncharged tRNA gets put into the ejection slot and is ejected. And where the new peptidyl tRNA gets shifted over to the P slot that corresponds to its name, and that leaves an empty A slot for the new codon to be read. And so with expending two GTPs each amino acid, this goes on for however many codons there are that specify amino acids. Remember, there's 64 codons, right? But only 61 of those specify amino acids, because there are three special codons that function as stop codons. So as long as the A slot is reading the next codon that is any codon other than a stop codon, this will continue. And the polypeptide will get longer and longer, one amino acid at a time. That's elongation. Now let's talk about termination, slide 18. So eventually, one of the three stop codons will be the one that comes up into the A slot. Now, compare start and stop codons. The start codon, there's only one of them, AUG, does double duty, because it's not only a start codon, but it also specifies an amino acid. That's not true for the stop codons. There's three different ones, but they act identically, so it doesn't matter which one you use. But they only act as stop codons. They don't also specify amino acids. So there is no tRNA corresponding to any of the three stop codons. Wouldn't make sense, right? Because they don't specify amino acids. And therefore, when any one of these three stop codons comes up into the A slot, it's not a tRNA that comes in. Instead, it's a special protein shown in yellow here called a release factor. This is another case of the word factor denoting some special kind of protein, like growth factor we talked about earlier. Release factor comes in, and the release factor is not carrying any amino acid because the stop codon basically is telling this ribosome, in the previous step, you just added the last amino acid already. Now it's time to let it loose and dismantle this translation complex that was built earlier. So the release factor signals that, and you can see that what happens is tRNA releases the now complete polypeptide. It's now an uncharged tRNA, so it can go back and get recharged. And the messenger RNA detaches from the ribosome, and the ribosomal subunits detach from each other, and so does the release factor itself. Everything dismantles, basically, except you still have what doesn't dismantle, of course, is the mRNA itself. It doesn't disintegrate into individual nucleotides. It just is no longer associated with the ribosome. And that takes even more energy. Another couple GTPs need to get spent. So you need to spend GTP for initiation. You need to spend two for each additional amino acid that you add. And then you need to spend a couple at the end as well. So it's expensive to build a polypeptide. All right, that's termination. And this free polypeptide is called free because it's no longer being carried by a tRNA. It's on its own. And it will do whatever job it's supposed to do based on its shape once it folds up into its appropriate shape. But importantly, the messenger RNA has not been destroyed. It still exists, right? And there's nothing saying that it can't be used again. And in fact, it will be used for exactly the same purpose again as long as it exists. So when we talk about gene expression, it doesn't mean you make one transcript and then you make one polypeptide from that transcript. Whenever a protein is needed, you need, you know, thousands or millions of copies, not just one. So messenger RNA isn't used just once. It's reused for as long as it exists. But this is an important part of controlling gene expression because you don't want it to exist too long. You don't want to keep making copies of a polypeptide more than you need, right? That's expensive for one thing, but also they can interfere with things. So no mRNA transcript is allowed to hang around forever. They're, in a sense, pre-programmed to disintegrate after a while so that you make some number of copies, but a limit. And if you actually need more after that mRNA is destroyed, it's no big deal, right? You just go back to the library, transcribe again, and make a new copy of the mRNA so it can be used for its lifetime. Okay, now, in 19, we see something labeled as a polyribosome. This kind of goes along with what I was saying about the fact that mRNA can be reused multiple times. Not only can mRNA be reused, and by the way, every time it gets translated, it's going to make the same exact amino acid sequence, right? It's going to make the same polypeptide. But not only is it reusable, the messenger RNA doesn't have to wait until a ribosome gets to the end and completes the polypeptide before it is able to be used by another ribosome. Instead, a ribosome simply has to move far enough along so it's out of the way, and a brand new ribosome could come along and start translating behind it. That's what a polyribosome is. It's a single mRNA transcript, the red ribbon here, and all of the ribosomes that are simultaneously connected to it translating. Each ribosome is creating its own polypeptide, but because they're reading the same code just at different times, they're all creating, all of these polypeptides are identical copies of each other. So the left ones have just recently attached, the ones on the right have been there a while, that's why this one is done, this one's almost done, this one's a little bit behind it, and so on. That's a polyribosome. It saves time. There's no reason to wait until it's all the way done. You can get a bunch of copies of polypeptides made in short order this way. Okay, now to 20. We need to talk about control a little bit. If you think back to the chapter called A Tour of the Cell, where we surveyed all the major organelles, including ribosomes, we also talked about the endoplasmic reticulum, and specifically the rough endoplasmic reticulum. Remember, it gets its roughness, it appears rough under light microscopy, because the membrane of the rough ER is studded with a bunch of ribosomes. Okay? And the reason that makes sense is because the job, remember, of the rough ER is to modify newly made polypeptides. Well, all translation starts in the cytoplasm, meaning all polypeptides start out being created on what is called a free ribosome. Remember, we use the words free ribosome and bound ribosome. A bound ribosome is, at the moment, while it's called a bound ribosome, it's attached to the membrane of the ER. But a free ribosome is on its own in the cytoplasm. And that's how all polypeptides start being translated, on a free ribosome. When it comes to polypeptides, you can think about it in terms of what's important here in two categories. Some polypeptides will not only start out being created or translated in the cytosol, but they will entirely be translated and assembled in the cytosol, and they won't need any post-translational modification, meaning that once the stop codon is hit and the polypeptide is released, it's ready to go, able to do its job. Okay, so they will not need the assistance of the ER, because the ER modifies. Well, they don't need any modification after translation. But then there's the other category of polypeptides, which are the ones that need to be built, of course, by translation, but they're also going to then need to be modified after translation. They're going to need post-translational modification. That's what the ER is for. So the question is, how does the cell know for any given polypeptide which is which? How does it know whether it's going to need to be modified? And the answer is that part of the polypeptide itself, a short length at the beginning, the first several amino acids in the overall sequence, serves as a little signal to the cell saying, because of this particular sequence, that means I am one of these polypeptides that need to be modified. Okay? So the green signal peptide is what I'm talking about here in this cartoon. Notice it's coming off of a free ribosome, like all polypeptides start out as. If the signal peptide is recognized, then it will know it needs help. But how does it recognize it? Well, that requires the help of a protein. This orange protein, notice, is called a signal recognition particle. And it has just the right shape, kind of like an enzyme to a substrate, that it will recognize of this particular signal peptide that's coming off of the translation assembly line. And it will allow it to bind to it. And when that happens, then this whole complex, the translation complex, which is both ribosomal subunits, the mRNA transcript, and the emerging polypeptide, plus the signal recognition particle will all move toward the membrane of the rough ER. And then there's going to be interaction between two proteins. One of the proteins is the protein that just bound to the signal peptide. That's the signal recognition particle. But it also has another part on its surface that has just the right shape to bind to a protein that's part of a complex of proteins that form little pores or openings in the membrane of the rough ER. So that's what's being docked right here. And when this docking occurs, it positions this emerging polypeptide in just the right position so that when it gets even longer, it will be strung right through that tunnel into the lumen, the hollow interior of the endoplasmic reticulum, which is exactly where a polypeptide that needs to be modified should be placed, right? Because that's the job of the ER. And the ribosome looks like it's part of the membrane when it's in this position, and thousands of others at that moment are also docked. That's why it looks like it's studded with ribosomes. And it is, but no ribosome is permanently there. It's just there temporarily until that polypeptide gets built. And then it will leave, and new ones will come and dock to it later. So at any given moment, there are many ribosomes attached. But anyway, the polypeptide continues to be built. It gets longer and longer, but now it's inside the ER, and the ER then, based on what kind of protein it is, figures out what the modification is, which totally depends on the kind of protein. One possibility, for instance, is that some polypeptides don't want to have that methionine as part of their structure, but they have to because that's the start codon that tells them right. So one modification is to remove the methionine from certain polypeptides. But other things can be added that aren't protein and so on. Those are the job of the ER. All right, 21. Now we need to talk a little bit more about mutation. We've already talked a little bit about mutation, and in fact, we've already talked about this specific mutation in humans that leads to sickle cell disease. This is a mutation in the gene, one of the genes coding for hemoglobin, but mutation in general, not just this example, mutation in general is some change to DNA sequence. It's accidental. Mutation happens either simply by accident or because something goes wrong because of a so-called mutagen. A mutagen is something that causes mutation, like a certain chemical or ultraviolet light is mutagen. In any case, though, when a mutation happens, it's a mistake because there is a sequence of DNA nucleotides that is the gene. You know, it's a certain sequence that's supposed to be there in a sense. If it gets changed, then that's going to change the information. Well, the simplest mutation, the smallest scale is what I mean by simplest, is what's called a point mutation, because it affects just a single nucleotide. But DNA, of course, is double-stranded, so if you're talking about one nucleotide position, there's also, in that same position on the other strand, a different nucleotide. So one position is really called a nucleotide pair, right? Still one position, but it's both strands. And that's the simplest possible mutation. In this case, this particular triplet, which is just one of many triplets in the gene, is supposed to be CTT. That's the so-called wild type. Wild type means before a mutation. And in this particular mutation, the T gets changed for whatever reason into an A, C-A-T instead of C-T-T. Once a mutation happens, and mutations happen often and then get repaired by the proofreading mechanisms, but if the proofreading mechanism doesn't catch it, then the mutation becomes permanent and the cell has no idea it's wrong. It's just going to obey it as a code, right? So if you don't have the mutation in the wild type, CTT, which is which is part of the template strand. Remember, only one of the two DNA strands gets read. That's going to, by complementarity rules, specify in the mRNA GAA. And when you look up GAA in the genetic code, in translation, that's going to correspond to glutamic acid as the amino acid here. That's what the GLU stands for. Well, if you change the T into an A and have CAT, then the cell doesn't know that's wrong, so it normally transcribes it, but it's going to transcribe it into a codon in mRNA that is GUA, not GAA. And when you look up GUA, it's not glutamic acid, it's valine that gets put down there instead. And the rest of the polypeptide is correct. All those amino acids are in the right place. It's only that one that's wrong, but that can make a big difference to how it folds. Because secondary and tertiary structure, in quaternary if it has it, all depends on primary structure, which is the specific sequence. And shape is everything, because if you don't have the right shape, the protein's not going to work. That's just a specific example. 22 gives you a rundown of point mutations. And you have normal, so-called wild-type DNA at the top of some gene. Notice there's two columns below it, though. And the left column involves a kind of mutation called base pair substitution. Now, a base pair is one nucleotide pair, like I was saying. It's one position, but both of the strands. The word substitution tells you that there is a swapping, right? In substitution, something gets substituted for something else. One nucleotide gets substituted for another, like in the previous example, previous slide's example. So if a substitution happens, that means the overall length of the DNA sequence doesn't change, right? You still have the same number of nucleotides. It's just one of them somewhere in that sequence is different. Well, that's important for reasons I'll get into when we look at the right column. But a base pair substitution happens the same way in all cases, but it can lead to different effects, the first of which is called a silent mutation. It has nothing to do with sound, but silent means that it's not noticed. A silent mutation is a mutation. The DNA is now different, but it's not going to have any effect at all on the trait, because the trait depends on the protein, right? And in a silent mutation, the correct protein still gets made despite the mutation. And the reason that can happen is because of the redundancy of the genetic code that we talked about. The genetic code is redundant because 64 is more than 20, right? You have more codons than you need to specify all 20 amino acids. Therefore, there are multiple codons that specify the same kind of amino acid. And a silent mutation is one that the change in the DNA, like the CCA here instead of CCG, gets transcribed into a different codon in mRNA, GGU here instead of GGC, but both of those codons still specify the same amino acids, so you end up in translation creating the correct polypeptide. No effect at all. You'd have to look at the DNA to even tell that it exists as a mutation, because you make the correct protein. On the other hand, you can have a missense mutation, which means getting something wrong. It's like getting one word wrong in a sentence, where a word is a codon. So in this example, what was supposed to be... Where are we? Supposed to be ACC instead is ATC. And... I'm sorry. It's supposed to be it's supposed to be CCG right here. It gets mutated into TCG, so that gets transcribed as AGC instead of GGC. But when you look up AGC, it specifies serine, not glycine. So that's exactly what happened in the previous example I just showed you. That's a missense because you get one amino acid wrong. All the others are still correct. And so maybe that protein will work, and therefore it's survivable. Maybe it will work, but not quite as well. Maybe it will work even better than the original. And this is how natural selection works, right? When mutations just randomly happen that actually make a version of a protein that works slightly better, then those are the ones that get favored. Those organisms live longer and pass that new version on to the next generation. Okay, the other possibility for a base pair is nonsense. That's getting more than just one word wrong. And that happens when a change in the DNA causes a change in the mRNA from one codon that specifies an amino acid to any one of the stop codons. So when it gets changed to a stop codon, then the cell just obeys the stop and thinks it's done, and it won't add any more amino acids. So that's very hard to survive, right? Because that protein is almost certainly not going to do the job. It's too short. The column on the right shows you what are called either base pair insertions or base pair deletions. As the names imply, insertion means adding a nucleotide in between two that exist. A deletion means taking one out without replacing it. So whether it's an insertion or a deletion, it's going to change the total number of nucleotides, unlike a substitution, right? And this has much more widespread effects because of how a messenger RNA gets read. It gets read one codon at a time, right? Kind of like we read a sentence one word at a time. The overall sentence has a meaning, which is kind of like the overall shape for the function. And we don't have too much of a problem distinguishing words in a sentence because we use spaces. Well, there aren't any spaces in the mRNA. The reason it can get away with that is because, unlike our words, which can be any length of letters, every word, every codon, is exactly 3 letters long. So as long as it knows where that first word is, which is what the start codon specifies, all it has to do is read one codon at a time, each codon being 3 letters. Well, if you insert a letter in between there somewhere, that's going to change, it's going to shift. It's called a frame shift because you shift the frame of reference. Let me give you an analogy with a sentence made up of only 3-letter words. For instance, if you have the sentence, the red dog ate the cat. That has a certain meaning, right? Well, an insertion would be like, for instance, if I add a Z in here between the H and the E of the, that turns the whole sentence now into something that's nonsense. It's going to be THZERE DDO GAT. Do you see where I'm going there? See where those come from? Because it shifts everything by one letter. So an insertion mutation affects not only that codon it's part of, but all the other codons as well. And the same thing would happen if I took one of these letters out. It would be shifted to the left by one letter, and it would affect every 3-letter word. So those kinds of mutations, insertions and deletions, it gives you a totally different protein, and that's very unlikely to work. But it can still happen 3 ways. You can have an insertion or a deletion cause nonsense or extensive missense. Now to 23. This is a picture of something that happens in prokaryotic cells, but not eukaryotic cells. And that's because eukaryotic cells are compartmentalized, like we talked about. In a eukaryotic cell, you have to have gene expression, the two parts of gene expression, transcription and translation, occur in different compartments, right? Well, it's all the same compartment in a prokaryotic cell. So transcription and translation both happen in the cytoplasm, which is where the DNA is. Here you have one gene, the blue DNA, in a bacterium as a representative prokaryote, being simultaneously transcribed by multiple different RNA polymerase molecules. Right? So you're not only making multiple copies of the same mRNA transcript, but you're doing it at the same time on one gene. as soon as one gets out of the way, a new RNA polymerase can come and clamp on. It doesn't have to wait to the end. And therefore, each of these red mRNA transcripts will eventually be identical once they're complete, but they're in different stages of completion. And since the prokaryote doesn't have to wait for transcription to end and modify that transcript to get it out of the nucleus that it doesn't have, that means that an mRNA doesn't even have to be totally done being transcribed before it can start being translated. As soon as enough nucleotides of the mRNA get hang off of the assembly line for transcription, a ribosome can come along and clamp on there and start translating it before the transcript is even complete. So you have multiple polyribosomes simultaneously hanging off of one gene being transcribed. And that means prokaryotes can really make a bunch of copies of the same protein that it needs in very short order, which can be very important because if you need that protein to survive the next minute, that's a big deal. If you lose the one cell that you are, you're dead. So they need to be able to make these quickly. Well, 24 is the last slide of the unit, and this is really just a summary. I've talked about all of this before, but let me go through it just for the sake of refreshing your memory. This is a summary of the entire process, gene expression, and specifically in a eukaryote, as you see. But first, we start with transcription. You have one gene, the blue DNA. It's double-stranded, but remember, only one of those two strands is actually used in the process of transcription. That's the template strand, which in this case is this bottom one. It's being read, and the egg-shaped RNA polymerase molecule is reading one nucleotide at a time from the DNA to determine what kind of RNA nucleotide it adds to the growing transcript. When that's done, you have pre-mRNA, because this is a eukaryotic cell, and it therefore needs to be the pre-mRNA needs to be post-transcriptionally modified for it to be able to work. One of the things that it needs the post-transcriptional modification for is to be able to get out of the nucleus. So you put the yellow ends on, the poly-A tail and the 5' cap that we talked about. That allows it to get out. But you also use a spliceosome, not shown here, to recognize all the introns, cut them out, and splice together all the exons, which will be in the final product, the mature mRNA that's coming out. The mature mRNA then meets up with a ribosome, or multiple ribosomes maybe. This one coming here is going to clamp on and start reading it, starting with the start codon, and that's initiation, and going through elongation for however many codons that specify amino acids there are in the transcript. And that's what tRNA's job is to do, is to bring in each additional amino acid appropriately until finally a stop codon is reached, and that will end the process. But using these tRNAs, of course, requires charging them with their appropriate amino acid, and that involves the various kinds of aminoacyl tRNA synthetase enzymes, each one specific for a kind of tRNA. That maintains the integrity of the information. And let me make sure that's it. Yes, it is. So just remember Scantron on Thursday, but I'll see you later today.